with a few days' violent activity. The alternative method of losing weight did not seem to occur to him. He continued to eat heartily 3 times a day. A guest at lunch noticed that waiters were always moving toward the president. He had, besides, a sound domestic reason to quit town as soon as possible. The newly restored White House was ready for occupancy, or would be, as soon as it stopped reeking of fresh paint and varnish. Edith was busy choosing fabric and furnishings for some 20 large rooms. Such delicate details were beneath his robust attention. To hunt swatches of chintz was a woman's job, to kill Ursus Horribilis, a man's. On 4 November, Roosevelt was chagrined to see Oyster Bay fall to the Democrats. Only the traditional Republican vote of northern New York saved his native state from a takeover. Governor Benjamin B. Odell, Jr. won re-election by fewer than 10,000 votes. Nationwide, the Democratic Party gained 26 new congressmen. Even so, analysis of the results showed that the GOP had performed better than normal for a ruling party in off-year elections. It still had a House majority of 30 seats, ample for legislative purposes, and its margin of dominance in the Senate was unchanged. Some seriously eroded fields of support south of the Mason-Dixon line could be written off as Democratic territory anyway. Everywhere else, except Nevada, the aggregate of votes cast indicated statewide Republican pluralities. Roosevelt's hopes for nomination in 1904 were thus extended to probable election as president in his own right by a margin of nearly 170 electoral votes. No doubt he would never capture Dixie, but the rest of the country offered a dazzling perspective. The only flecks in this kaleidoscope were those of Republican insurgents in the Midwest, Governor La Follette of Wisconsin looming particularly large. One of these days, that particular crystal would have to be shaken into the pattern, no matter how jarring its color. A signboard reading Smeeds dripped with the damp of a Mississippi autumn afternoon. On one side of the rails was a depot, on the other a plantation store. Cotton fields sprawled dully, their extent incalculable behind curtains of mist. About 20 Negroes waited on bales, swinging their legs and staring down the track toward Vicksburg. The president had tried to keep the location of his hunting trip secret, but Bush Telegraph advised that he would look for bear hereabouts on the banks of the Little Sunflower River. Among the bale sitters, at least, Roosevelt was guaranteed a welcome. Ever since his dinner for Booker T. Washington, Southern blacks had called him "our president" and compared him to Lincoln. They did not care that he had only just announced his first appointment of a Negro to high federal office, Dr. William D. Crum, collector designate of customs in Charleston, South Carolina. It was good enough that he elsewhere favored moderate white Democrats over the lily-white extremists of his own party. Had not Dr. Washington himself declared Roosevelt's opposition to any further drawing of the color line in Southern politics? Within the depot, 2 plantation owners were also waiting. George H. Helm and Hugh L. Foote were not ashamed to show support for the president in a state where so many of his own race despised him. Roosevelt could hardly have chosen a worse time to visit the Yazoo Delta. The idea of Dr. Crum, wealthy, cultured, conscientious, but black, seated in a position of power overlooking Fort Sumter, was incendiary enough to revive the passions of a year ago, not to mention the passions of 1861. James K. Vardaman, a prominent Mississippi Democrat, had openly advertised for 16 coons to sleep with Roosevelt. Given such propaganda, the president's hosts were worried about a possible assassination attempt, hence the secrecy surrounding his hunt and the remoteness of his camp, 15 miles east of Smeeds, in a privately owned forest choked with budvine and briar. Only one access trail had been hacked. Armed guards were on patrol, ready to stop with buckshot any unauthorized stranger. Shortly before 4 o'clock, a locomotive and private car steamed out of the mist and clanked to a halt. Roosevelt emerged in leather leggings, a blue flannel shirt, and a rough corduroy jacket. Around his waist was a cartridge belt, flashing with steel-jacketed and soft-nosed bullets. An ivory-handled hunting knife rode on his hip, and he gripped his favorite .40-90 Winchester. The gun was custom-made, with a crescent cheekpiece that somehow helped alleviate Roosevelt's 8D myopia. Its walnut butt was scarred with Colorado cougar bites. He stepped down with a crunch of hobnail boots onto Mississippi soil, followed by George Cortelyou and the rest of his hunting party. Helm and Foote, assuming he wanted to shed his presidential identity, addressed him politely as Colonel. He shook hands, then heaved himself onto a waiting horse. His companions mounted too, and they rode off together into the fog. The next 5 days made for the worst hunt of Roosevelt's life. Simply exasperating, I never got a shot. Bears were not rare around the little sunflower, just rare wherever he went. His veteran catcher, Holt Collier, lifetime tally 1,600 specimens, tried to lure game within range of the presidential rifle, yet hunter and prey invariably moved in different directions. The other men in the party did not dare to bag anything themselves. Roosevelt insisted on first blood. "I am going on this hunt to kill a bear, not to see anyone else kill it." Embarrassingly, he had given representatives of the three press agencies permission to visit camp once a day. The resultant non-stories caused national hilarity. He was obliged to let his companions shoot a bear and a deer, if only to soothe their southern pride. Paradoxically, one misadventure worked to his political advantage and spawned the most enduring of all Rooseveltian myths. Early on the morning of 14 November, Holt Collier's hounds scented bear and began to yelp. Roosevelt and Foote galloped after the pack, but thickening brush cut them off. Collier tactfully suggested that they stake out a nearby clearing, while he rounded up the critter and drove it past them, same as anybody would drive a cow. The yelping of the hounds receded into silence. Roosevelt and Foote sat for hours, sweating as the sun climbed and cooked the humidity of the forest. Noon came, and with it boredom and hunger. Eventually, they concluded that Collier's bear had gone astray, so they might as well ride back to camp for lunch. No sooner had they left than a lean black bear burst through the brush with the pack at its heels. Hot and exhausted, it lunged into a pond, and the dogs splashed after it. The bear reared and struck out, crushing one hound's spine. Collier threw a lariat over the shaggy neck and pulled tight. Then he waded in and cracked the bear's skull with the butt of his gun, carefully, because he wanted it to stay alive. Back at the camp, the hunters heard excited horn calls. A messenger from Collier galloped up. "They done got a bear out yonder about 10 miles, and Ho wants the colonel to come out and kill him." Roosevelt rode back at full speed. He was both disappointed and upset, on reaching the pond, to find a stunned, bloody, mud-caked runt tied to a tree. At 235 pounds, the bear was not much bigger than he. He refused to shoot. "Put it out of its misery," he said. Somebody dispatched it with a knife. The hunt continued for another 3 days, but the curse of that tortured bear kept Roosevelt's bullets cold. He did not know, as he crashed vainly through the mists, that the outside world was already applauding his sportsmanlike refusal to kill for killing's sake. Clifford Berryman, the Washington Post cartoonist, was inspired to make a visual pun, linking the incident with the president's race policy. He sketched a very black bear being roped about the neck by a very white catcher, and Roosevelt turning away in disgust with sloped rifle. The cartoon appeared on the front page of the Post on 16 November, captioned, "Drawing the Line in Mississippi." Whether or not readers got Berryman's pun, they rejoiced in his imagery and demanded more bear cartoons after Roosevelt returned to Washington. Berryman obliged again and again as he realized he had hit upon a symbol the public adored. With repetition, his original lean bear became smaller, rounder, and cuter. He drew it as a poor, measly little cub with most of its fur rubbed off and big ears like prickly pears, and it became the leitmotif of every cartoon he drew of Theodore Roosevelt. That winter, by one of the mysterious coincidences that yoke inventions, stuffed plush bear cubs with button eyes and movable joints began to issue from Margareta Stief's toy factory in Gingen, Germany. 3,000 were ordered by F.A.O. Schwartz of New York City, while in Brooklyn, a storekeeper named Morris Michtam began producing something similar at $1.50 each. The competing bears soon fused, along with Bearman's cub, into a single cuddly entity that attached to itself the nickname of the President of the United States. For decades, perhaps centuries to come, uncounted millions of children across the world would hug their teddy bears, even as the identities of Stief, Michtam, Berryman, and Roosevelt himself rubbed away like lost plush. Edith Roosevelt received her husband in a White House immeasurably different from the dark, dank mansion they had inherited from the McKinleys. Gone were the executive offices crowding the second floor and the malignant outgrowth of greenhouses on the west facade. Gone were the sagging floorboards that needed to be shimmed up during receptions, the barroom glass screens and scuffed wooden chairs, the curly wallpaper and wainscots jaundiced with 50 years of tobacco spit. Gone, too, were the mustard carpets, the dropsical radiators, the sad-smelling laundry, the vertical wooden pipes that made flatulent noises in wet weather. Best of all, gone was the china hen, hatching a nestful of china eggs, that had bid a glazed welcome to every visitor to the vestibule since the time of President Hayes. For this improvement alone, the Roosevelts were entitled to the thanks of a grateful nation. But McKim, Meade, and White had done more than strip. They had extensively rebuilt, while remaining faithful to Roosevelt's injunction that the White House should be restored to what it was planned to be by Washington. Outwardly, it was the same, except for fresh paint and the addition of two sweeping, pillared pavilions. Even these were not altogether new, for the Eastern Pavilion rose on the site of one demolished 30 years before, while the Western, designed by Benjamin Latrobe and Thomas Jefferson, was simply exposed after decades of being hidden behind greenhouse glass. The pavilions flanked a spacious basement that had been transformed into reception rooms, capable of handling thousands of visitors at a time. In place of pipes and boilers, now sunk out of sight and earshot, there were parlors for ladies and gentlemen entering from the new porte cochere on East Executive Avenue. A separate, oval luxury lounge was provided for diplomats arriving through the south door. The vaulted corridor linking these suites with the central stairway made an art gallery. Edith Roosevelt had graced its white walls with portraits of first ladies. Now Dolly Madison, Lemonade Lucy Hayes, and Edith herself, sumptuously portrayed in white chiffon by Theobald Chartrand, could observe the flow of guests strolling up to the ground floor. "The first impression one gets," an architectural critic wrote of the main vestibule, "is that its size has been greatly increased. Cleared of all clutter, refinished in buff and pure white, soaring above marble slabs that shone like mirrors, the hall seemed to breathe light and air. A delicate screen of wrought iron barred any further ascent of the stairs, while 6 stately columns invitingly revealed the crimson-carpeted corridor. There was a dramatic feeling of entrance, of access to power. Thanks to solid reconstruction, it was now possible to walk the length of the corridor without creakings or precautionary detours. A further burst of light heralded the East Room. This great parlor was so changed that only people remembering the days of President Monroe could view it without shock. Charles McKim had scraped, chipped, and burned away 84 years' accretion of fust and filigree, leaving nothing but the original walls. New waxed parquet reflected 3 coruscating chandeliers. Bronze standards glowed in every corner, and marble wainscots and consoles augmented the general radiance. 12 classical bas-reliefs replaced the dark portraits that used to hang over the doors like guillotine blades. Window drapes and banquette seats were of yellow silk. The room's only Baroque decoration was a magnificently carved and gilded grand piano, courtesy of Steinway & Sons. South of the corridor, the three smaller state parlors had been relined with silks and velvets, but they kept their traditional color schemes at Roosevelt's command. A pair of exquisitely carved empire-style mantels adorned the green and red rooms. The blue room in between was stiff with corded silk. Two new silver-knobbed side doors allowed for a speedier flow of handshakers past the president at receptions. The most Rooseveltian and least authentic of McKim's restorations was the state dining room, almost two-thirds larger than the old, with seating for more than 100 guests. It was oak-paneled and mahogany-furnished, the chairs padded with tapestry. A disgruntled-looking moose and some dozen other North American game mammals stared glassily out from the walls, bracing for years of presidential monologues. Roosevelt, marching through, did not affect any aesthetic rapture. Subtlety, balance, refinement of line, harmonies of color and texture escaped his eye, as music bypassed his ears. To him, game heads were not decorative statements, so much as reassuring tokens that he was, pace Mississippi, a mighty hunter. Gentlemen of his class, McKim included, felt at home dining beneath tusks and antlers ensconced in oiled wood. Even effete little Henry Adams liked this room. Breeding, however, saved Roosevelt from the pretensions of the nouveau riche. Having deaccessioned the China hen, he felt no urge to replace it with a Japanese miniature tree or a collection of Bavarian steins. He was too much of a professional himself to venture any amateur design suggestions. Indeed, his only mild criticism was that here and there McKim had not been austere enough. Upstairs, Edith Roosevelt had fewer scruples. Fortunately, her fondness for brown and green upholstery and pink and green garlanded curtains left intact the structural grand plan. Two big new bedrooms, where the executive suite used to be, increased the White House's total of domestic apartments to 7. Now that Kermit had followed Ted to Groton, there was plenty of room for houseguests. The Oval Library had been turned into an elegant parlor, suitable for the entertainment of fashionable ladies. Next door, the former cabinet room became Roosevelt's writing den, with leather chairs, a deep fireplace, and yards of books. Knowing her husband's love of all things nautical, she set an old desk, carved from the timbers of HMS Resolute, in the center of the room. Here, late at night, after she had gone to bed, he could work on the final draft of his second annual message. The document was half the length of its predecessor, and clearly the work of a cautious chief executive. Roosevelt had little to say on matters of domestic policy, except to demand a special fund for antitrust prosecutions, and to insert the word urgent into his repeat request for a Department of Commerce. He took a peaceable survey of international affairs, noting that the United States and Mexico had just become the first powers to submit a legal dispute to The Hague. As civilization grows, he wrote, warfare becomes less and less the normal condition of foreign relations. Yet he could not resist pointing out a corollary responsibility for the strong to maintain order. More and more the increasing interdependence and complexity of international political and economic relations render it incumbent on all civilized and orderly powers to insist on the proper policing of the world. By this he did not mean to threaten well-behaved Latin American nations. On the contrary, they could look for protection against European aggression under guarantee of the Monroe Doctrine. The Western Hemisphere was secure. There is not a cloud on the horizon at present, not the slightest chance of trouble with a foreign power. With these bland words, Theodore Roosevelt revealed, or rather further concealed, an unguessed aspect of his character, namely that of the covert diplomat practicing Louis XV's secret droit. Foreign policy was, he acknowledged, the subject on which I feel deepest. The very depth of his feeling convinced him that negotiations, in times of crisis, should be private and verbal, hence undocumented. He had a far-flung network of intermediaries and informants, men of diplomatic or intellectual or social stamp, by no means all Americans. Most of them were globe-trotting friends from pre-presidential days, such as Cecil Spring Rice of Berlin, Constantinople, and St. Petersburg, Henry White, chargé d'affaires at the American Embassy in London, and Arthur Hamilton Lee, a Tory member of the British Parliament. Their urbane, literate reports kept him up to date with court affairs and privileged gossip. As members of the Sacré, they were able to negotiate without paper and keep agreements quiet, protecting the sensitivities of parties. They, in turn, could trust Roosevelt's absolute discretion. Not until after he left the White House would he reveal, confidentially, that in late 1902, the United States was on the verge of war with Germany. Even then, his allusions to the Venezuela business were to be cryptic and contradictory, enough for a generation of historians to call him a liar. 7 decades had to pass before cohering bits of evidence suggested that the basic facts of the story were accurate, and that Roosevelt had remained silent about it in order to spare the dignity of an emperor. The full extent of the crisis would have to be inferred circumstantially from an extraordinary void in the archives of three nations, deletion after deletion, hinting at some vanished enormity, a painted-out battle of titans, visible in pentimento through layers of pale wash. Roosevelt had seen the crisis coming for 11 months. It involved a familiar situation, failure by a Latin American republic to repay European loans. Venezuela, bled white by civil war and corruption, owed some 62 million bolivars to an impatient consortium headed by Great Britain and Germany. These powers, acting in unlikely alliance, were now proposing to blockade Venezuela with a multinational armada until Caracas paid up. Both nations had scrupulously assured the United States that they were interested in debt collection only and had no desire to establish footholds in the Western Hemisphere. The president sympathized with their frustration. Ever the stern moralist, he blamed Cipriano Castro, caudillo of Venezuela, for ignoring honorable obligations. The fact that Castro was only 5 feet tall and simian in appearance confirmed his general prejudice against Latin Americans as political primates, low in the pantheon of nations. To evolve, they must be taught responsible behavior, or, as he robustly advised a contemporary houseguest, the German diplomat Speck von Sternberg, "If any South American country misbehaves toward any European country, let the European country spank it." Baron von Sternberg, about to return to Berlin, was a charter member of the Sacré du Roi. British-born and educated, married to a pretty blonde from Kentucky, he had known Roosevelt since 1889. He understood that uninhibited private language did not necessarily translate into policy. However, this was no longer the young civil service commissioner blustering away at the Cosmos Club. This was the President of the United States, dominating a new, austere White House that gave off a chilly radiance of power. When Roosevelt condoned the spanking of New World republics, then, one had to remember a significant qualifier in his first annual message. Provided that punishment does not take the form of acquisition of territory by any non-American power. Current Anglo-German assurances of benign intent suggested that this qualifier was being heeded. Roosevelt believed, at least, what Britain said. The Hay-Pauncefote Treaty amounted to a guarantee that King Edward's government had no designs on the Western Hemisphere. But a secret memorandum from Rear Admiral Henry Clay Taylor, Chief of the Bureau of Navigation, warned that Germany was otherwise inclined. Taylor wrote that the Kaiser's navy would bombard Venezuela within weeks if President Castro resisted the blockade. She would then certainly demand indemnity for her expenses. But Castro had no money. Thus, in logical steps, Venezuela could offer nothing but territory, or mortgage her revenue in such a way as to place herself in complete political dependence on Germany. The United States could not allow either of these, and yet Germany's right to indemnity would be incontestable. The only courses open to the United States would then be payment of the indemnity, taking such security as she can from Venezuela, or war. The first method, Taylor concluded, is cheapest, the second most probable. His argument had crude force. Roosevelt was saddened by the whole situation. "I have a hearty and genuine liking for the Germans, both individually and as a nation." His identification with German culture was deep and strong, dating back to his days as a teenage student in Dresden. German blood flowed in his veins. He could recite long passages of the Nibelungenlied by heart. Frederick the Great and Otto von Bismarck rated among his personal heroes. Part of him welcomed the idea of German capital investment in Latin America on the ground that countries such as Venezuela would benefit from development by a superior civilization. Another part of him agreed with Taylor that Germany wanted more than dividends in the New World. There was an ominous sentence in her proposal to co-sponsor the blockade. "We would consider the temporary occupation on our part of different Venezuelan harbor places and the levying of duties in those places." The adjective temporary reminded him that in 1898 Kaiser Wilhelm II had temporarily acquired Jiaozhou, China, on a lease that had somehow lengthened to 99 years. Germany's well-known shortage of Lebensraum, in Spring Rice's phrase, its curbed feeling, translated into an explosive need for new horizons. Burgeoning yet hemmed in, the Reich had to feed 1 million new mouths a year and market a gross national product that was doubling every decade. Its army was already the most formidable in the world. Now it was building a huge new navy. This combination of social, economic, and strategic aggrandizement, to a president who had recently reread Theodor Mommsen's History of Rome, portended the rise of a new militaristic imperium in Europe, just as the sun was beginning to set on British South Africa. What better place to establish a collection house today, a colony tomorrow, than lush, crippled Venezuela? Spring Rice and von Sternberg had given Roosevelt, over the years, a shrewd idea of the Weltpolitik of Germany's militaristic ruling class. Expansionists, such as Chancellor Bernhard von Bülow, regarded the Monroe Doctrine as an insult, at best a hollow threat. Alfred von Tirpitz, Secretary of State for Naval Affairs, made no secret of his desire to establish naval bases in Brazil, where 300,000 Germans lived already, and in the Dutch Caribbean islands. Germany, therefore, stood isolated in Roosevelt's sights as he braced himself for the shock of foreign aggression in South America. He could not guess that at even deeper levels of secrecy, Wilhelmstrasse strategists were working on a plan for the possible invasion of the United States. The plan called for Tirpitz to dispatch his fleet to the Azores at the first signal of transatlantic hostilities. From that point, the fleet would steam south and take Puerto Rico, then launch surprise attacks along the American seaboard. A likely landing place was Gardiner's Bay on Long Island, which meant that when German troops advanced on New York City, they would march right past Roosevelt's house. The president, lacking precise intelligence, had to rely on intuition as the Venezuelan crisis developed. Fortunately, that intuition, in situations concerning the Monroe Doctrine, was acute. His animal Americanism, a buffalo nervously sniffing the prairie wind, sensed the circlings of a distant predator. As long as Tirpitz held off, there had been no formal blockade announcement yet, he could technically state that the diplomatic horizon was clear. But he gave notice in his message that the United States was looking to her defenses. "For the first time in our history, naval maneuvers on a large scale are being held under the immediate command of the Admiral of the Navy." Coincidentally or not, these maneuvers were directed at the same theater as the Anglo-German blockade. On 21 November, four battleships of the North Atlantic Squadron arrived off Isla de Culebra, Puerto Rico. Four cruisers and two gunboats of the Caribbean Squadron lay in wait for them. From other points in the Western Hemisphere, other white warships put to sea, converging like slow bullets upon the target area. Sea power, that early obsession of Roosevelt's youth, had returned to haunt him as Commander-in-Chief. Since entering the White House, he had been, in his own words, straining every nerve to keep on with the upbuilding of the Navy. Perhaps his most important achievement in that regard was the appointment of two ardent strategic reformers as Secretary of the Navy and Chief of the Bureau of Navigation. William H. Moody and Admiral Taylor were working to create a larger, more war-ready fleet. They did not lack for funds. Roosevelt's first message to Congress had generated enough money to finance the construction of two new battleships and two armored cruisers, plus a special appropriation for the maneuvers. The President had also, at the urging of a messianic young lieutenant named William S. Sims, instigated a program to improve fleet marksmanship. With less fanfare, he had approved a 6-month survey of the Venezuelan coastline and had transferred control of Culebra to the Navy Department in case of sudden war. The most recent tables of world naval strength rank the United States behind Britain, France, and Russia in ships built and building, but ahead of Germany at 507,434 to 458,482 tons. This position would soon improve, since the United States had more tonnage under construction than any country except Britain. Germany, however, had more vessels in commission, especially in the Atlantic, at 12 battleships to 8 American. The latter were more heavily armored, with standard 12 and 13-inch guns, but in aggregate fighting mass, Germany enjoyed an advantage of about 50%. For 2 years, tacticians at the Naval War College had been trying to combat this in maneuvers charted across an ocean of cartographic paper. They sat cross-legged on contoured islands or perched on mainland stools and smoked and threw dice while celluloid ships, blue for the United States, black for Germany, crept over the grid lines, trailing dotted wakes and firing tiny broadsides of pencil. The results were not encouraging. In almost every engagement, black's tighter track curves, the sheer range and accuracy of its lead, combined to scatter blue all over the table. Germany, the tacticians concluded, could seize key harbors in any Caribbean confrontation. A more optimistic view was put forward by the General Board of the Navy, the duty of which was to review such findings for the President. It found that if he established another base south of the one at Isla de Culebra, the hemisphere would be secure as far south as the Amazon. As far as Roosevelt was concerned, the forthcoming maneuvers would show, better than any calculation by college or committee, just how much sea power the United States actually had. Real ships and real guns were being committed to this game. If Germany and Britain wanted to splash in the same water, they must play by American rules, or the game could become deadly. He was able to stage a tableau to this effect at his first dinner in the new executive dining room on 24 November. Pale, frail Speck von Sternberg was the guest of honor. Elsewhere at the same table sat pale, frail John St. Lo Strachey, editor of the London Spectator and another of Roosevelt's cosmopolitan circle. The two foreigners were visiting America for personal reasons, in response to invitations from the White House. They had opposing rooms upstairs. Each had been vouchsafed a flattering presidential tête-à-tête, von Sternberg at dead of night, Strachey on horseback in the rain. Agog at such favors, they could be counted on to return home with the kind of intelligence that, in von Sternberg's phrase, was better talked over than written. The Baron was well-connected on the Wilhelmstrasse, and Strachey, through his periodical, was one of the most powerful opinion shapers in Britain. Between the two foreigners, Roosevelt placed the Admiral of the United States Navy as someone who could not fail to impress them. George Dewey, about to leave for the Caribbean exercises, was America's greatest military hero. He had destroyed the entire Spanish fleet at Manila in 98. Given permission, he would have bombarded Germany's ships, too. Blessed by Admiral Farragut and anointed by McKinley, he gave off an almost divine aura. There were people who carried little icons of him at their bosoms. Some Filipinos thought he communed directly with God. The admiral was now almost 65. His immaculate mustache was snowy, and his well-pressed uniform did not hang as straight as it had 3 years before, the day he rolled down Fifth Avenue behind Governor Roosevelt's prancing horse. Too many good lunches at the Metropolitan Club had pinkened the mahogany tan. He tended to nod off in the late afternoon. Awake, however, Dewey still had formidable authority, accentuated by the glitter of 4 gold stars. As Roosevelt reminded him, in the orders sending him back to sea, his standing was enough to ensure world attention to the Caribbean maneuvers. But Dewey had more than prestige to suit the president's current purpose. He was notoriously the most bellicose Germanophobe in the United States, and if Speck von Sternberg could not see that over the white flowers and wine glasses, he needed a stronger monocle. The next day, Britain and Germany officially informed the State Department of their intents to proceed against Venezuela. There would be an ultimatum followed by a blockade, within the bounds of the Monroe Doctrine. Secretary Hay replied that the United States greatly deplored any European intervention in the affairs of a South American republic. He conceded, however, that such action was sometimes justifiable. Meanwhile, the United States Armada off Culebra was joined by a flotilla of support vessels, including colliers and torpedo boats. Farther south, 2 battleships and 4 cruisers of the European and South Atlantic squadrons met near Trinidad, at a point only 125 miles from the Venezuelan coast. Finally, on 1 December, Admiral Dewey went down to the Navy Yard in Washington, where Roosevelt's yacht Mayflower awaited him as his flagship. He ordered its crew to prepare for the open sea. Chapter 13. The Big Stick. One good copper with a hickory club is worth all the judges between Amsterdam and Rotterdam. On the morning of Dewey's departure, Roosevelt drained his umpteenth cup of coffee, then spent 20 minutes walking in the garden with Edith. They had come to treasure this early ritual, now that his work took up most of the day and much of the night. The stroll helped him digest 3 breakfast courses, or rather 6, as he usually ordered both choices of each, plus a bowl of fruit or cereal. Edith fondly let him eat as much as he liked. She believed that his intellectual turbine, whirring always at abnormal speed, needed a proportionate supply of fuel. At 8:50, before going indoors, she would pick a rosebud for his buttonhole. Then, with her kiss warming his cheek, he would march along Jefferson's colonnade toward his office in the new executive wing. It was a treat not to have to operate out of home anymore. This neutral space, full of winter sun, pleasingly separated his work from his private life. As Roosevelt gave all of himself to each, so he disliked to have the one encroached upon the other. Any person with legitimate business to transact could see him where he was going, but in future only those worthy of intimacy might venture back the way he had come. The sense of a little flower shop greeted him as he traversed the President's Passage and entered a hallway dividing the cabinet room on his right from the executive office on his left. The latter was a spacious, southward-facing chamber, 30 feet square, hung with dark olive burlap, and simply but solidly furnished. Behind his massive mahogany desk, unencumbered by a telephone, an instrument Roosevelt deemed suitable only for clerks, 3 tall windows framed in triptych the Washington Monument, a lawn still red with construction mud, and Virginia rising beyond the Silver River. Another set of windows looked east toward the residence. If he caught sight of Archie or Quentin misbehaving in the garden, he had only to heave up a sash and roar at them. Thick doors and a no-smoking sign insulated him from supplicants and sycophants collecting in Secretary Cordelieu's big office beyond, and from gentlemen of the press, who now had their own den down the corridor. An oil portrait of Lincoln hung over the mantel, where he could see it at all times. Logs glowed in the fireplace. A tiny clock ticked. Polished leather under his cuffs reflected an Art Nouveau lamp and silver bowl of American Beauty roses. The room's main decoration was a huge globe. Spun and stopped at a certain angle, this orb showed the Americas floating alone and green, from pole to pole, surrounded by nothing but blue. Tiny skeins of foam, visible only to himself as Commander-in-Chief of the United States Navy, wove protectively across both oceans, as far south as the bulge of Venezuela and as far west as the Philippines. Asia and Australia were pushed back by the curve of the Pacific. Africa and Arabia drowned in the Indian Ocean. Europe's jagged edge clung to one horizon, like the moraine of a retreating glacier. When Roosevelt spoke of the Western Hemisphere, this was how he saw it. Not the left half of a map counterbalanced by kingdoms and empires, but one whole face of the earth, centered on the United States. And here, microscopically small in the power center of this center, was himself sitting down to work. There was nothing much he could do right now about the Caribbean theater, except wait for an opportunity to invoke the Monroe Doctrine there, once and for all. President Cleveland had attempted to do so definitively against Britain in 1895, also in a matter regarding Venezuela, but Lord Salisbury's government had backed down too soon for any American show of force. Roosevelt held that only power and the willingness and readiness to use it would make Germany understand the Monroe Doctrine fully. If he could send such a forceful message, it would round out Cleveland's policy nicely. Few among the president's callers that morning saw his new globe as anything other than a piece of furniture. Congress was back in town, not the newly elected 58th, but the same old 57th, reconvening for its last winter session. Senators and representatives paid their usual respects and declared their usual keen interest in the message he would be sending them later in the day. For 2.5 hours, Roosevelt pumped hands and exchanged pleasantries. Toward noon, his flow of visitors slackened, as congressmen and correspondents headed for Capitol Hill. The White House grew quiet. Even Edith and Alice took a carriage to watch the opening ceremonies. Roosevelt remained at his desk. Behind him, as he worked, the USS Mayflower dropped down the Bright River. For the next week, he remained closeted in the White House, giving no hint of anxiety about Venezuela. By 4 December, Secretary Moody had authorized a concentration of 53 warships, the largest such deployment the Navy had ever seen, compared with 29 Allied vessels. The imbalance signified nothing, of course, since neither armada was contending. Still, Roosevelt had real strength available if he needed it. He knew the historic propensity of blockades toward invasion. On 7 December, Germany and Britain informed President Castro that they were closing their consulates in Caracas and initiating Pacific measures to satisfy their claims against him. Admiral Dewey simultaneously took command of the fleet off Culebra, under orders to be ready to move south at an hour's notice. He began an immediate program of dummy landings along stretches of the Puerto Rican shore that resembled Venezuela's. As if toughening himself for the crisis to come, Roosevelt intensified his latest exercise routine, single sticks. Every evening in the residence, he and Leonard Wood donned padded helmets and chest protectors and beat each other like carpets. "We look like Tweedledum and Tweedledee," the president joked. General Wood noted in his diary that Roosevelt was too excitable a stick fighter to remember the rules. "It is almost impossible to get him to come to a guard after having been hit or delivering a blow." Despite bruised shoulders and swollen wrists, the two old Rough Riders soon graduated to heavy ash rods. "Speak softly and carry a big stick" was a West African proverb Roosevelt had tried out once as vice president and memorized as a personal mantra. Perhaps the current situation would enable him to test its effectiveness, starting with the soft speech. If a man continually blusters, if he lacks civility, a big stick will not save him from trouble. But neither will speaking softly avail, if back of the softness there does not lie strength, power. On 8 December, the German ambassador, Theodor von Holleben, visited the executive office with a party of his compatriots. The appointment was ceremonial. However, it gave Roosevelt a chance to talk to the ambassador privately, without attracting the attention of reporters. He was adept at drawing callers aside on such occasions and hissing something forceful through smiling teeth. The reason for his circumspection was that he had to deal, through von Holleben, with the most dangerous man in the world. Wilhelm II, Emperor of Germany, loomed clear in his imagination, clearer perhaps than if they had actually met. Roosevelt was too good-natured to be a perceptive judge of people in the flesh. For several years, even before becoming vice president, he had been receiving apprehensive reports about the Kaiser from mutual acquaintances. Cecil Spring Rice, for one, saw Wilhelm as an economic and military expansionist with a definite plan to consolidate German interests in South America. General Wood, just back from observing the German army maneuvers at Potsdam, did not know what to be more impressed with, the Kaiser's bewitching personality or his domination of an inhumanly efficient military machine. Roosevelt, the Germanist, admired Wilhelm's finer Teutonic qualities, as he did those of Helmut Karl von Moltke and Albrecht von Roon. He was also aware of some beguiling similarities between the Kaiser and himself. Only 3 months separated their respective dates of birth, Wilhelm being the younger. Physically, they were alike in their burly, grinning virility, their hunting prowess, and their conquest of juvenile disability, in the Kaiser's case, a withered left arm. They had the same quick nerves, charm, explosive speech, and weakness for moralizing. They were chaotic in intellect, encyclopedic in memory. They shared a passion for things military, identifying particularly with sea power. However, as Roosevelt pointed out, superficial similarities between men or nations accentuate their serious differences. In contrast to his own steely sense of direction, he saw a brilliant waywardness in Wilhelm, as of running mercury. The Kaiser was vain, coarse, romantic, and often foolish. He was xenophobic in general, and anti-Semitic in particular, given to hoarse shouts of "Ein Reich, ein Volk, ein Gott." His fits of rage were so violent as to make onlookers sick. What made Roosevelt most wary was Wilhelm's inclination toward bejeweled fantasy. "He writes to me pretending that he is a descendant of Frederick the Great. I know better and feel inclined to tell him so." The Kaiser liked to dress up as Frederick. When he posed for photographs in his hero's thigh boots, he revealed rather wide hips. Roosevelt, alive to any hint of effeminacy, understood that in negotiating with Wilhelm, he must at all times remember the importance of show. It would be foolhardy to humiliate him in the Caribbean. The Kaiser was enough of a man to stand a tough, confidential message, and enough of a woman, presumably, to retreat if it could be made to look glamorous. According to Roosevelt's later testimony, he spoke to Ambassador von Holleben with extreme emphasis and told him, "To tell the Kaiser that I had put Dewey in charge of our fleet to maneuver in West Indian waters, that the world at large should know this merely as a maneuver, and we should strive in every way to appear simply as cooperating with the Germans, but that I regretted to say that I should be obliged to interfere by force if necessary, if the Germans took any action which looked like the acquisition of territory in Venezuela or elsewhere along the Caribbean." The tactfulness of this warning was lost on von Holleben, who doggedly repeated Germany's official position. His Majesty had no intention to take permanent possession of Venezuelan territory. With a touch of sarcasm, Roosevelt said that he was sure Wilhelm felt the same about Jiaozhou, which was merely held by a 99-year lease. Again, von Holleben failed to react. Roosevelt politely informed him that he would wait 10 days for a total disclaimer from Berlin. If none was forthcoming, Admiral Dewey would be ordered south to observe matters along Venezuela. The ambassador escorted his party out. "You gave that Dutchman something to think about," said William Loeb, who was doing secretarial duty. But Loeb wondered if von Holleben had the courage to transmit an ultimatum. "I don't think he will give the Kaiser a correct picture of your attitude." The Pacific blockade turned violent the next morning, 9 December. 4 Venezuelan gunboats were seized by the Allies, and 3 of them destroyed by Germany. President Castro, in a panic, proposed that all claims against his country be arbitrated, and asked the United States to intercede for him. John Hay relayed Castro's proposal to London and Berlin, while Roosevelt considered the implications of his secret ultimatum to the Kaiser. The sinking of the gunboats struck him as an act of brutality and useless revenge. If Der Allmacht was this willing to lay violent hands on Venezuelan shipping, what price Venezuelan real estate? More than ever, Roosevelt suspected that Germany wanted to establish a strongly fortified place of arms near the future Isthmian Canal. He himself was pledged to violence now, unless von Holleben brought him a peaceable message in the 9 days remaining. More than 8,000 miles away, the only detached units of the United States Navy steamed to a routine rendezvous at Manila. Neither the Pacific nor the Far Eastern Squadron was needed for Caribbean duty, but Roosevelt had never forgotten that, in 1898, it had taken the battleship Oregon 64 days to rush from San Francisco to Florida via Cape Horn. Palpably, between the extremes of his divided fleet, a mirage of locks and water shimmered across Panama. In Berlin, Speck von Sternberg was reporting to Chancellor von Bülow and State Secretary Olaf von Richthofen on his recent visit to America. He cautioned them against basking in the illusions of Roosevelt's extravagant welcome to Prince Heinrich 9 months before. They must be aware of a steady deterioration in United States-German relations. Expressionless, self-effacing, and cunning, von Sternberg had his own interests in mind. He knew that Roosevelt was uncomfortable with Ambassador von Holleben and would prefer a more congenial envoy in Washington. "I feel absolutely confident," he wrote the president afterward, "that a radical change must take place. Of course, I didn't say a word as regards myself as a candidate." Roosevelt did not mind members of his secret du roi advancing themselves, since by doing so they usually advanced American foreign policy. A little farther down in von Sternberg's letter, he read, "The Venezuelan crisis is causing a considerable stir here." There seemed to be a similar stir in London, where St. Lo Strachey was railing in The Spectator against one of the most amazingly indiscreet alliances ever made with a foreign power. British popular opinion was generally against shared adventurism. In the United States, newspaper hostility toward Germany rose to such a pitch that von Holleben sent a worried cable to the Wilhelmstrasse. Von Bülow passed it on to the Kaiser, who scrawled irritatedly in the margin, "Herr Ambassador is over there to take the pulse of the press and to calm it when necessary by administering proper treatment." Wilhelm agreed, however, that Germany should refrain from any more unilateral displays of force. "We will allow our flag to follow the lead of the British." The ink on his superscription was scarcely dry when the British Royal Navy obliged off Puerto Cabello. The captain of an armored cruiser, responding to some insult to the Union Jack, bombarded the Venezuelan coast, and a German cruiser joined in, heavily damaging 2 forts. Roosevelt continued to believe that Germany was the really formidable party in the alliance. Sir Arthur Balfour's government had to find a way out or jeopardize the rapprochement between the 2 great English-speaking powers. One thing was certain: Britain would declare neutrality in any clash over the Monroe Doctrine. Sunday, 14 December, dawned gray and bitingly cold in Washington. The White House stood shrouded in weekend quiet. But the clock of war ticked on. 4 more such dawns, and Roosevelt's deadline would expire. Then Theodore von Holleben came to see him. If Roosevelt expected an answer to his ultimatum of 8 December, he was soon disappointed. Von Holleben was a diplomat Eltera Schuler, a sociable old Prussian with a bachelor's paunch and mild, misty eyes. His booming laugh precluded conversational attack. He preferred to do business in writing, with long delays between dispatch and response. The characteristics of his diplomacy were concern about America's rise to world power and what John Hay called mortal terror of the Kaiser. Today, von Holleben seemed interested in talking about only the weather and, of all things, tennis. When he rose to go, Roosevelt asked if his government was going to accept the arbitration proposal transmitted by Secretary Hay. The ambassador said, no. Controlling himself, Roosevelt replied that Kaiser Wilhelm must understand he was very definitely threatening war. Von Holleben declined to be a party to such language. The president said that in that case he would advance his ultimatum by 24 hours. Calculating back to 8 December, the deadline would now fall on the 17th rather than the 18th. Von Holleben, shaken, insisted that His Majesty would not arbitrate. Roosevelt let him have the last word. William Loeb saw the ambassador go, but made no log of his visit. Neither did clerks at the State Department or the German Embassy. It suited everybody concerned that blank paper should obliterate the diplomatic record. Wilhelm was still free to end the crisis without evidence of being coerced. Von Holleben pondered Roosevelt's incredible threat. He could transmit it now, if he dared to transmit it at all, only as a matter of extreme urgency. Contrary to von Sternberg's insinuations, he had long been aware of the rise of anti-Germanism in the United States, to the extent of predicting war, sooner or later, over the Monroe Doctrine. But the Kaiser had scoffed at his qualms. "We will do whatever is necessary for our Navy, even if it displeases the Yankees. Never fear." This ultimatum might well be Rooseveltian bluster. Von Holleben did not want to be dismissed as an alarmist. But what if the president was serious? Von Holleben decided to consult a German diplomat in New York who knew Roosevelt well, Consul General Karl Bunz. Under cloak of a snowstorm, the ambassador left town. Late that evening, he registered at the Cambridge Hotel, Manhattan. Sometime during the next 24 hours, Bunz assured him that the president was not bluffing. Nor was Roosevelt's short-term strategy flawed. Whatever the worldwide strength of the Kaiser's navy, it was currently dispersed. Admiral Dewey was therefore in a position to deal a brutal blow to German prestige in the Caribbean. As von Holleben struggled with this frightening information, diplomatic strains developed between London and Berlin. Lord Lansdowne, the British Foreign Secretary, found himself in a difficult position, with King Edward VII expressing annoyance at the Venezuelan entanglement, and the German ambassador, Count Paul von Metternich, insisting the Kaiser would not arbitrate. Lansdowne wondered querulously if the Allies could at least agree on the principle of arbitration and perhaps invite the United States to weigh some of their claims against Venezuela. This was the first hint that the British government wanted Theodore Roosevelt to help resolve the crisis. His neutrality, not to mention his recent mediation of the Great Coal Strike, recommended him as an arbitrator. But Metternich would not budge. It was now Tuesday, 16 December. Fewer than 24 hours remained before Roosevelt's deadline. In New York, von Holleben went down to Wall Street to check the latest fluctuations of German-American and Latin-American opinion. In London, the British cabinet approved Lord Lansdowne's proposal to accept arbitration in principle, thus driving a wedge into the alliance. In Washington, the Roosevelt cabinet met in closed session. And in San Juan, Puerto Rico, a fast torpedo boat stood ready to rush any emergency orders to Admiral Dewey. "Such cables," Admiral Taylor alerted Naval Intelligence, "may be written in cipher and are to be considered confidential." He reminded all staff that "there are many matters connected with the business of the fleet here which are not a proper subject for discussion." After less than an hour in the cabinet room, Secretary Moody hurried back to his office with a presidential order. A White House spokesman said that it concerned Christmas visits that the fleet would make to various Caribbean ports. Reporters soon learned that Dewey's big battleship squadron was headed for Trinidad, only 60 miles from La Guaira. And why was the Navy Department handing out detailed maps of the blockade zone? Throughout the crisis so far, Roosevelt had pursued a policy of apparent candor and cooperation with the press, issuing regular bulletins about the maneuvers, along with qualified assurances that he was handling the Allies with restraint. "He sees little reason," the Washington Evening Star noted that afternoon, "to be throwing out unofficial intimations to Germany and England that this country has fixed a deadline which they must not cross." The truth or untruth of this statement lay in the adjective unofficial. By now, the ambassador's unexplained absence from town was causing comment along Massachusetts Avenue. He was scheduled to attend an evening reception at the home of the British ambassador, Sir Michael Herbert. Protocol clearly required that he make an appearance, but darkness came, and von Holleben was not seen. Neither were the German military and naval attachés. They had slipped away to join their leader in New York. From there, before midnight, certain words flashed to Berlin. Roosevelt was not to know exactly how von Holleben transmitted his threat of war, only that the threat got through, on a night when the Atlantic cable was so electric with communications that even the Times of London was denied access. Once read, von Holleben's words were probably burned, in approved German security fashion. His dispatch of record for 16 December 1902 advised only that, "Now the cannons have spoken, and Germany has shown the world it is willing to assert its fair rights. We would make a good impression on all Americans if our government were to accept arbitration in principle." The reaction in Berlin was immediate. On 17 December, the Reichstag voted secretly to accept arbitration, in such haste that other encouragements, from Hay in Washington and Metternich in London, were redundant on receipt. So the deadline passed in peace. There could be no end to the blockade until arbitration actually began, but a massive release of tension was felt on both sides of the Atlantic. Roosevelt's triumph was von Holleben's disgrace. The ambassador remained in New York while arrangements were made to bring him home on permanent disability leave. "I am a sick man," he told a reporter. "I cannot answer a single question." He had misjudged a president, misled an emperor, and nearly started a war. His only consolation was that the Wilhelmstrasse could not cite these as reasons for his recall without making the decision to arbitrate seem forced. To save the Kaiser's face, it was necessary to save von Holleben's. Discreet cooperation from the White House made both expedients possible. On 19 December, Germany and Britain formally invited Roosevelt to arbitrate their claims against Venezuela. He said he would think about it, and left town with his children to spend a day or two in the pine woods of northern Virginia. Cortelyou announced that the president had been under great strain, both mentally and physically, in the Venezuela crisis. This was the nearest Roosevelt got to a public acknowledgment that there had indeed been a crisis involving himself. "I suppose," he wrote privately, "we shall never make public the fact of the vital step." Overflowing with goodwill, he went out of his way to praise things Teutonic at a meeting with trade representatives of the Kaiser. For 20 minutes he spoke, in vigorous if ungrammatical German, of Goethe, Schiller, Lessing, and Theodor Körner. "He astounded us," one of the group said afterward. "He is as well posted on German affairs as on American. His familiarity with the masterpieces of German literature would amaze even the most exact scholar in the fatherland." Roosevelt reserved his decision on whether to act as arbitrator through the holidays. John Hay felt sure that he would, in the end, resist this chance for easy glory and refer the case to the International Court of Justice at The Hague. Feeling a surge of tenderness, he put his rusty poetic talents to work and composed a Christmas Eve ode to the President of the United States. "Be yours, we pray, the dauntless heart of youth, the eye to see the humor of the game, the scorn of lies, the large Batavian mirth, and, past the happy, fruitful years of fame, of sport and work and battle for the truth, a home not all unlike your home on earth. Snow fell as the secretary wrote. His poem joined the other presents piling around the White House Christmas tree. Chapter 14. A Condition, Not a Theory. We insist that though this happy fellow citizen may pass us our victuals, he shall not fork out our stamps. The equilibrium of the world is moving westwards. A member of the Institut de France told Jean-Jules Jusserand early in 1903. Jusserand, packing his ambassadorial uniform for Washington, did not disagree. An intellectual himself, he was a specialist in medieval culture and had published several works of literary and social history, he accepted and mourned the decline of French power. Yet it coincided excitingly with the rise of his own diplomatic fortunes. At 47, he found himself entrusted with a mission of major importance, to protect France's Entente Cordiale with her sister republic from increased competition by foreign monarchies. Tunis and Copenhagen had been nothing next to this. Clearly, he had been selected less for experience than for brains and youthfulness, qualities now much in demand on Massachusetts Avenue. In Berlin, 50-year-old Baron Speck von Sternberg was also packing for transfer. Britain's 45-year-old Sir Michael Herbert had been at his post for 3 months. All three ambassadors had American wives. Equally clearly, Jusserand saw that his life as half-scholar, half-envoy was over. Washington had little time for historiographical musings. As his friend at the Institute put it, "You will no longer decipher manuscripts, but men." Jusserand could write in Latin and read 14th-century English with perfect fluency, but could he construe Theodore Roosevelt? The task had been too much for his predecessor, Jules Cambon, who seemed to doubt the president's sanity. Speculation about Roosevelt was intense at the Quai d'Orsay. French foreign policy experts believed him to be the strongest international personality since Bismarck, yet they could not reconcile the